I'm going to read what somebody else has wrote, and that would be Benjamin, who says, well, I agree with Simon, no guns capitalized, like Britain. Even the police should only have firearms for specific officers, and then only when a situation warrants it.
It's a very interesting thing, and you and I could wax lyrical, and we could argue this point, but I think that we should welcome Chairman of the ZACP, Canton Pillay. Welcome to 5FM.
This is brilliant. It's taken me, what, you know, 10
years?
10 years to get here, and suddenly I'm here twice in a month. This is lovely.
Well, welcome. Welcome to 5FM. Canton, Simon made a comment about, firstly, thank you for the time. I think you're a brave man to go into politics. Simon made a comment about guns, right, Simon?
I certainly did.
Out of 10 points on the ZACP, you said you weren't happy about the gun policy. I don't know what the gun policy is. Can you tell us what's your gun policy before we get to the other stuff?
Okay, there's two aspects to the gun policy.
Yep.
The first is the entire idea that individuals have the right to defend themselves, which is kind of at the core of it. And in terms of the 10 plans that we put forward around how we want to fix very specific things in society, you know, right now that we have one of absolutely the highest levels of violence against women anywhere in the world.
Yes.
You know, so, and, you know, so it's incredibly high murder statistics against women and children. It's incredibly high rape statistics. And every year we have these 16 days of activism against violence against women and children, and nothing ever comes of it. And our view basically is that one way that you can start making a dent in these horrendous figures is by empowering women to defend themselves. And so essentially what we are proposing is to actually teach the skill of shooting to high school kids, high school girls in particular, and to equip them with the skills to make use of a firearm. We're not suggesting we're giving them guns. But what we are suggesting is that they be trained in the safe, responsible use of firearms from the time that they are at high school, so that by the time they grow up and become adults and productive members of society, if they choose to, they are already at that stage effectively licensed because they've gone through an upskilling process and are then able to acquire firearms for their own self-protection at that point. So that, in essence, is what we are trying to do. The difference between our existing legislation and what we are hoping to achieve, our existing legislation right now, we feel, puts too much emphasis on licensing the weapon rather than the person. To put this in perspective, the equivalent would be that instead of licensing the driver, you end up licensing the car every time. So every time the person ends up buying a new car, you make them take a driving test, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So we are saying flip that around, put the maximum emphasis on the skill set that the person who is going to hold the firearm actually has. And ultimately, I'd like to think that we end up with a safer country as a direct result of that for a couple of reasons. Right now, there are lots of firearms on our streets. Every one of us who has armed response, there are people out there carrying guns. And a lot of them happen to be people with criminal records. A lot of them happen to be people who've never been properly trained in the use of firearms. And frankly, would I rather that my daughter was properly trained in the use of a firearm and carried one for self-protection, or some random person that whichever security company I subscribe to, you know, sends to my place without having necessarily gone through the process of knowing how to shoot, when to shoot, and whether to shoot.
You know, there's another element to this, Canton, and that is that if you're licensing the person rather than the firearm, as the ZACP, the Purple Cow Party, I have to call it the Purple Cow Party. That's what you've come to know.
We're very happy with Vote Purple Cow, yes.
Is that somebody who, say, for example, you've got a police officer or you've got a security officer. Something's happened in his life and he's now suffering from depression. Or he's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. If that gun is licensed, he can still carry that firearm.
Absolutely.
But if he has to be licensed, he can't. And that is so important.
That's absolutely right. In fact, one of the things that we've actually said,
those are real situations,
that you actually need to be mentally competent to be able to carry a firearm.
Simon, look how he's looking at me. No, look how he's looking at me.
Fine. I'm my co-host is a Trumpist of note, and that's fine.
What has Trump got to do with this? Nobody said anything about Trump.
It's unbridled free liberalism to the nth degree.
Actually, I need to hop in on that particular point. Trump actually did more for arms control than Obama did, because Trump banned bump stocks.
Sorry, well, what?
What are bump stocks?
Bump stocks are things that you attach onto a semi-automatic that effectively turns it into a rapid-fire weapon.
Okay.
And Trump outlawed them.
I love that argument. I know we used to talk about other things, but this gun thing really does interest me. The American Constitution, the right to bear arms, this was a concept that arose, in the 1700s and the creation of America. And you had a gun with a musket. With a musket. You could shoot one bullet, wait 5 minutes, and then load another. That was the right to bear arms. It wasn't to buy a
right
semi-automatic.
It's a right to protect yourself.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah, but it's...
If somebody comes into your home, are you telling me that you're going to say, oh, I'm sorry, I don't have a gun?
So you're busy shooting people dead and they're potential rape victims. There's going
to
be a lot of dead people all over the place.
Somebody comes into my home to rape me or hurt my children or my family.
I prefer the Tasmanian model where there was a mass shooting. They then banned guns in Tasmania. There hasn't been a mass shooting since.
Yes, but Australia, the people next to you, if people in the car next to you, if you can hear their radio, you report them and they get fined. Australians, you report your neighbors all the time.
So maybe that's the issue
that's
that
not,
we're discussing
that's
here,
not,
is what kind of society do you want to live in?
I can't believe you guys brought me in here to talk about guns, though. I mean, surely they're...
Simon's thing.
I think, frankly, out of, the 10 principles that we've got as the Capitalist Party...
I wanted to tackle that one, because
Okay, no, I agree. Let the guns go.
Kenton, what are you going to do about power generation?
Easiest thing to do about power generation is to lift the ridiculous restrictions that government has put in place on how much independent power producers may feed into the grid.
Why do they have that?
They have that because it's essentially protectionism for Eskom. But it ends up being a bad thing. And the reason why it ends up being a bad thing, let's take a typical example. Let's say you happen to be Anglo-American and you have a particular mine that is running maybe 3 shafts and you put in place power generation capacity in order to support those 3 shafts. And you've got a slight bit of extra capacity, which you can sell to Eskom to feed into the grid. But because of the fact that the government puts a limit on how much electricity may be fed into the grid, there isn't an incentive on the part of Anglo to now go and bring in additional power generation capacity. Now, if they were able to sell all of the additional power generation capacity at better rates than Eskom is currently charging, by the way. If they were able to, then potentially they'd be able to open a few more shafts based on the fact that they've now got electricity to provide for that, which would not be cost effective if they were not able to sell on the additional surplus capacity. So it actually ends up being a win-win scenario. Just by that simple act of lifting the restrictions on power generation, you're immediately making it cost effective for big businesses that could really benefit from having extra power capacity and then being able to sell the surplus on to Eskom. It would fix the problem immediately.
All right. Another problem that I've heard about in terms of service delivery is where, post 1994, we've got policies like BEE, and I recognize, as somebody who benefited from apartheid, I recognize that jobs were held by people who benefited from the apartheid system, but those people also had knowledge. So knowledge about the areas in which they were working, and that's whether it was in our waterworks, whether it was in electricity, Eskom. What are your plans to upskill? Because we don't apparently have the skills. The more people I speak to, people are saying, no, they're bringing back these guys who were fired after apartheid as consultants at 4 times the price.
There are 2 different problems we're trying to solve here. The first problem, of course, is the entire concept of BEE and affirmative action is stuff that we reject in its entirety. We want it removed.
Why?
We think it's the single biggest obstacle to us being able to build a meritocracy in this country. And we want to live in a meritocracy where we're putting the best possible people into positions at any given stage. The question of upskilling goes back to the problem in terms of our school system. And that problem is not going to go away for so long as you've got this unholy alliance between the African National Congress and the Southern African Democratic Teachers Union. And there is no incentive whatsoever for the ANC to fix the township schools, which are all run by SATU, and they're an absolute disgrace. We have the SATU teachers who are there purely because of their membership of SATU, and they cannot read, write, and count themselves. And they are meant to be there teaching our kids. So until we have fundamental changes that take place in terms of education, this problem is going to stay there. And the question of upskilling, we're getting further and further away from being able to generate sufficient intellectual capital to fill those positions. One of the things that we are proposing in terms of how we end up immediately improving the numbers of people that we're injecting into the tertiary system is by doubling up on the number of learners that currently go to the former Model C schools. And we are proposing that we do that by running two shifts at those schools. So you start one shift very early in the morning, 7 a.m., and run that through until around about 12:30. And then you start a second shift from 1 p.m. and run that until 6:30. So the kids who are there for the morning classes, they can do sports in the afternoon. The kids who are there for the afternoon classes can do sports in the morning. But effectively what we are doing is making use of the same facilities. Maths and science, which are the scarce skills, what you do is you position those classes in the middle part of the day. So sort of starting at 10 a.m. and going on to 2 p.m. So those teachers teach those classes twice. And then you just bring on an additional contingent of teachers for the early morning and late afternoon to take up the other stuff.
So you're using your resources more and it's keeping those kids off the street.
Exactly, yeah.
And this is going to level playing fields?
No, it's starting to make a dent. Okay.
Okay, well, that's
Look, the problem, there's no silver bullet for this stuff. The problems that we have in our country right now are so massive that we have to look at it like eating an elephant. And the way you eat an elephant is one mouthful at a time. And I understand elephants are not kosher. We're not going to go there. But like I said.
No, but purple cows apparently are.
Purple cows are very kosher. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Very interesting.
Kathy, we've had Rakhadi weigh in. She says, afternoon, Kathy and Simon. Please ask your guest about how the Purple Cow Party is funded and would they be willing to disclose their donors?
We're funded entirely by ourselves, and every single one of our public donors is listed on our website, capitalist.org.za/donate. Every donation that comes in, either through PayPal or through our bank account or through PayFast, which are the three channels that we've got up there, as they come in, we update it on the website, and you're very welcome to go out there. We're very happy to accept money from big business. We're very happy to accept money from the CIA, from the KGB. I've reached out to Mossad. They've been ignoring me.
Have they really? You need to get hold of them on Twitter.
Good point. I never thought of that.
Or Telegram. They don't take calls.
Yes. Yeah. I thought of reaching out to Hezbollah, but they've got no money anyway, so it's kind of useless.
Or they're paying Iran. Bitcoin, probably. Yes. Yeah, you had a colleague with us about a month ago who said that morality doesn't come into the equation. It's what's good for the country. So if it means technology from Israel and oil from Iran, then that's what you'll do.
Make South Africa
great. I don't want us to say that that morality doesn't matter. I think morality matters. I think that the phrase that we use is enlightened self-interest. And it's got nothing to do with being immoral. You know, I think that one needs to have a separation between...
Maybe not immoral, maybe amoral, just factor morality out.
No, I don't think it's that at all. It's just that I think that you do these things at two separate levels. Because, I mean, for example, I think all of us can agree that the Saudis are one of the most heinous societies on the face of the earth.
Sure.
But that doesn't stop us from buying oil from them. What I'm saying is that you manage the diplomacy at the level of the diplomacy and you manage the trade separately. I mean, are we now going to start picking on China for all of their human rights violations?
No, well, exactly the opposite has happened. You know, if you look at what's happened with South Africa and Israel, that's exactly what South Africa has done. It doesn't matter. We don't want your technology. We don't want your medicine. We don't want anything.
Case.
So it's exactly the reverse of what you're saying, Simon.
Yes.
That's what South Africa's done. Our guest is Canthan Pillay. He's the chairman of the Purple Cow Party, the ZACP. You can go and check out. You want to find out more about them, capitalist.co.za.
Capitalist.org.za.
We have in studio with us a chairman of the ZACP, that is the Capitalist Party of South Africa. You've seen their purple cows everywhere. Every graffiti wall has a purple cow. I must say, I think that your marketing's been brilliant.
I have to acknowledge my wife's brilliance at this point. Dr. Sarah Britton, she's responsible for our entire marketing strategy.
She was one of our correspondents.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, no,
you've got a question, Simon.
No, I'm just fascinated how, to what extent your party has gained traction in such a broken society. I can understand how this libertarian idea takes root in America, where everybody kind of has a similar-ish starting point in this society that is so broken.
Why do people want to keep putting these labels on us, like libertarian or
free markets?
Oh, no, just call liberty.
I don't know how would you describe it?
People love to put us into boxes.
Simon, this is your party.
Yeah, Simon. I think the reason why we've gained as much traction as we have in such a short space of time is, for the first time, we've been putting forward a message that's actually speaking to the future. And we haven't been saying, look at what's wrong in our country. Look how terrible things are in our country. Rather, what we've been saying is, we've got brilliant people in this country, and we know how to fix things. And can we please start looking forward? Because the rest of the world is charging ahead, and we're spending all of our time looking in the rearview mirror. And really, if we can just shift our focus, speak to a messaging, a narrative that actually speaks to what we have in common, if you recognize that every single one of us really want the best for our families, and we want to leave our kids better off than we were. And if we can carve a narrative that's speaking to that, I firmly believe that people will pull together around that. And if you want the single reason why we've struck this chord, really, I think it's really as simple as that. That, you know, we've been speaking to the future and saying, can we pull together and build things together?
I can understand your attraction for the higher LSMs. Are you gaining any traction in the lower LSMs?
Well, frankly, that hasn't been our target market.
Yeah.
If you look in terms of the way in which the country works right now, we've got 17 million people on social welfare. We've got 14 million people in formal employment, out of which 7.5 million actually pay income tax. Now, out of that 7.5 million who pay income tax, they contribute 508 billion rand every year to the fiscus, all this year to the fiscus. And out of that 508 billion rand, 7 million of those taxpayers contribute less than half, and 500,000 people contribute the bulk of it. So the majority of that 508 billion comes from just 500,000 taxpayers who are leaving the country.
No, the brain drain is something.
The brain drain is real. And essentially right now, what we are doing is speaking to those 7.5 million people, and also speaking to those who want to be part of that 7.5 million people. In other words, those who are actually desperate for opportunities to get employment.
Let's inspire. Let's aspire to be taxpayers.
So what would be your philosophy on tax and social welfare?
Look, we need to wean ourselves off social welfare. Social welfare, in terms of the way in which we structured right now, is unsustainable because we are borrowing money to pay social welfare. It's an impossible situation. We can never recover from that. Look, there's no difficulty with us having a scenario like the Scandinavian countries, which are, they're capitalist countries. They are overwhelmingly capitalist, far more so than the United States, as an example. But because they generate enough wealth, they're able to plow money back into a strong social welfare network. And as capitalists, we have no issue with that whatsoever. Because if we're making money, you know, we should be free to spend it as we see fit. But borrowing money in order to pay social grants,
which people don't have to do anything for.
Yes, which people don't have to do anything for, is an absolute disaster. So we're proposing a system of negative income tax, which is not something that we've coined. It was actually first postulated by Milton Friedman around about the time when I was a kid, in fact. But the entire idea behind a negative income tax, because right now we've got a progressive tax system, which, you know, we're all familiar with. The more you earn, the greater the proportion of your salary that goes in income tax.
Sure.
And we're suggesting that right now 6,500 rand a month is the cutoff point for you to start paying income tax. Okay. And we're saying that if you earn less than 6,500 rand a month, then you should get a top-up from SARS. Not as much of a top-up as, you know, to bring you up to 6,500 a month. But let's say you earn 5,000 rand a month, and that's a 1,500 differential, then we'll get SARS to pay you back 50% of that, so that you end up with 5,750 rand a month.
Do the numbers work?
Look, the numbers work if you find ways of cutting expenditure at other level. So, yes, the most crucial thing we can do right now to put our country back on track is to look at the fact that out of every 100 rand that we spend, that we earn in tax revenue, government pays itself 34 rand. So that's a public service wage bill in our country. It's 34 rand out of every 100 rand that we pay in tax immediately goes there. So the most crucial thing that we can do immediately is to drastically reduce the size of government. And I mean absolutely drastically. One of the things we're proposing when we get into parliament is that we want a 34% reduction in salaries of all parliamentarians. That's one, going to be one of the first motions that we bring to bear in parliament. Obviously, they're going to fight us on that, but we're going to keep pushing at that. Because cutting government then frees up resources that you can then put into more useful and productive environments.
A lot of South African political parties have adopted a Marxist view. And that's because there are so many people in the country who don't have a way to win votes to say, I will give it to you. We will take it from the people who have and we will give it to the people who don't have. That is Marxist philosophy 101. And unfortunately, most of our political parties are. And it's also quite a dangerous situation because it's not realistic. You know, we're seeing what's happening with corruption. What are your hopes for this election? What are the outcomes, Canthan?
We've got a couple of positive things on our side.
I think you've got a lot of positive things on your side. It's fresh. It's fresh. Uh-huh. It's a new approach. And at this point for my country, I'm happy to look at any new approach.
Sure.
Really.
But one of the things that we've really got going in our favor as a country, as opposed to ourselves as the ZACP, you know, I was talking about those numbers just now. We've got 17 million people who are on social grants. We've got 14 million people unemployed. But we have a country of 57 million people. So that is a massive chunk of people in between who fall completely outside of both of those. So in other words, that's your missing middle. They are not in any way benefiting from what the ANC government has done in the past 25 years. And they are desperate for change. And the single biggest thing that we've got going in our favor is if we can build enough momentum around just exactly how the current policies are keeping them from employment. And it's protectionism at so many levels. Firstly, it's the affirmative action policies. It's things like minimum wage policies, which make absolutely no sense in a country with employment levels that are as low as we have right now. It's things like the unions actually shutting out people who are not part of the unions, who are willing to work for significantly less than the unions are bargaining for.
Are you another Margaret Thatcher?
Well, I certainly think that if one looks back in terms of what Margaret Thatcher did.
Yes. Well, she got rid of the unions. They were
completely crippling. Her starting point was exactly what we're talking about. She said the problem with socialism is that you eventually run out of other people's money to spend.
Yeah.
And that's and that's a scenario that we've got right now. So we feel very strongly that if we can put in place, again, sort of chipping away steadily at this edifice that's the National Democratic Revolution, if we can start showing how it is actually possible for those people in the middle to actually sustain themselves, then the ANC's power base actually collapses completely. And the 17 million is not sustainable.
Canthan Pillay, it has been an absolute privilege and a pleasure to speak to you. Love hearing what you have to say. I'm sure that it won't be the last time. Go and check out, if you want to find out more about the ZACP, go check out their website, capitalist.org.za. It's the Purple Cow Party. We've been speaking to the chairman, Canthan Pillay.
And give us money.
Yeah, go and give him some money. Go on. What's the point in being white monopoly capital if you can't give it away?